The History of Easter Island. I'll begin with a overview and summary in case you fall asleep in the first few minutes. Easter Island, also known as Rapa Nui, is a Chilean island in the southeastern Pacific Ocean. It is famous for its huge 887 statues called Moai, created by the early Rapa Nui people. Polynesian people most likely settled on Easter Island sometime between 700 and 1100 AD or CE. It is likely that they created a thriving and industrious culture, as evidenced by those huge statues, as well as other artifacts. But over time, some mysterious events, and some probably well-understood events, led to a large drop in the population, deforestation of the island, and other devastating effects of the culture and people of Rapa Nui. At its peak, there were probably about 15,000 people living on Easter Island. And then at another low point, there were only 111 people on the island. The rest of this episode will explore some more details about the island, the history of the island, and all these strange events that occurred on the island that led to the rise, the fall, and now the recovery of Easter Island. I'll begin with some interesting facts and historical details. Easter Island is a relatively small, triangle-shaped island. It is about 15 miles or 24 kilometers long, and about 8 miles or 12 kilometers wide. It is also one of the most remote inhabited islands in the world. The nearest inhabited island is Pitcairn Island, which is about 1,300 miles or 2,000 kilometers away. The nearest continental land is in central Chile, which is about 2,200 miles or 3,500 kilometers away. Currently, Easter Island is a special territory of Chile that was annexed in 1888. According to the 2012 Chilean census, the island now has about 5,800 residents, of whom some 60% are descendants of the Aboriginal Rapa Nui. The name Easter Island was given by the island's first recorded European visitor, the Dutch explorer Jacob Roggeveen. He named the island this because he first encountered it on Easter Sunday in 1722 while searching for a different island. The current Polynesian name of the island, Rapa Nui, was coined after the slave raids of the early 1860s. The name Rapa Nui means Big Rapa, and this name refers to the island's topographic resemblance to another island called Rapa. Now you may be thinking what I'm thinking. If Rapa Nui was a new island named after a prior island called Rapa, it seems that Rapa Nui probably translates into Rapa New or New Rapa. I looked into this but couldn't find any support. I guess it's just accidental phonetic coincidence that the word Nui sounds like the English word new, when it It actually means big. Oh, well. All right, back to the early history of Rapa Nui. Estimated dates of initial settlement of Easter Island have ranged from 300 to 1200 AD or CE, approximately coinciding with the arrival of the first settlers in Hawaii. However, radiocarbon dating analysis has changed this estimate slightly. Rapa Nui is now considered to have been settled in the narrower range of 700 to 1100 CE. Ongoing archaeological studies even suggest a later date of maybe 1200 CE. According to oral tradition, the first settlement on Rapa Nui was at the coastal area of Anakina. Researchers have noted that this coastal area provides the island's best shelter from prevailing swells, making it easier to land and launch canoes from here. However, radiocarbon dating at other sites suggest other areas of Rapa Nui were settled before Anakina was. The island was most likely populated by Polynesians who navigated in canoes or catamarans from the Gambier Islands or the Marquesas Islands. Either way, their trip would have been about a few thousand kilometers or a couple of thousand miles. Of those two options, a stronger argument can be made for the Gambier Islands, just because those islands are closer to Easter Island. Additionally, the language of Rapa Nui is 80% similar to the language spoken on the Gambier Islands. In 1999, a voyage with reconstructed Polynesian boats was able to reach Easter Island from the Gambier Islands in 19 days. When James Cook visited Easter Island, one of his crew members, a Polynesian from Bora Bora, was able to communicate with the Rapa Nui. This suggested an early connection between Easter Island and Bora Bora. It is also possible that early Polynesian settlers arrived from South America due to their remarkable sea navigation abilities. This is also supported through the agricultural evidence of the sweet potato. The sweet potato was a favored crop found among Polynesian society for generations. But the origins of the sweet potato traced back to South America, proving evidence of interaction at some point in time between South America and Easter Island. According to oral traditions recorded by missionaries in the 1860s, the island originally had a strong class system. This class system included a high chief wielding great power over 9 other clans and their respective chiefs. Now, why did the islanders build those large statues? The most visible element in the culture was the production of massive statues called moai. Although often identified as Easter Island heads, the statues have torsos, with most of them ending at the top of the thighs. A small number are complete figures that kneel on bent knees with their hands over their stomachs. Some statues may appear as being just a large head, but this is because they have become buried up to their necks by shifting soils. Some believe that these large statues represented deified ancestors, with each statue representing the deceased head of a lineage. According to National Geographic, quote, most scholars suspect that the Moai were created to honor ancestors, chiefs, or other important personages. However, no written and little oral history exists on the island, so it's impossible to be certain. End quote. The Rapa Nui people believed that the living had a symbiotic relationship with the dead, in which the dead provided everything that the living needed, such as health, fertility of land and animals, fortune, and other aspects. In return, the living Rapa Nui people, through offerings, provided the dead with a better place in the spirit world. Most settlements were located on the coast, and most Moai statues were erected along the coastline, facing inland. It is believed that they were placed here to watch over their descendants in the settlements before them, with their backs toward the spirit world in the sea. When and how did the islanders build those massive statues? The 887 statues were carved in 1100 to 1680 CE, as determined by radiocarbon dating. Almost all of them were carved from compressed, easily worked, solidified volcanic ash found at a single site on the island. The native islanders who carved them used only stone hand chisels, which lie in place all over the quarry. The stone chisels were sharpened by chipping off a new edge when it dulled. While sculpting was going on, the volcanic stone was splashed with water to soften it. While many teams worked on different statues at the same time, a single Moai statue took a team of 5 or 6 men about a year to complete. Of the almost 900 huge statues, 50% never made it out of the quarry. 25% were found en route to their intended locations, and only 25% were installed at a final destination. The largest statue weighs 82 tons and is about 10 meters or 32 feet tall. The statues were possibly moved by the use of a Y-shaped sledge with cross pieces. The sledge was pulled with ropes made from the tough bark of a native tree and tied around the statue's neck. Anywhere from 180 to 250 men probably pulled a sledge, depending upon the size of the statue. Another method that might have been used to transport the Moai would be to attach ropes to an upright statue and rock it, tugging it forward as it rocked. This might have been managed by as few as 15 people. This would fit the legend of the Moai statues walking to their final locations. At least 4 pieces of evidence support the transport of upright statues. Number 1. Some statues in transit were documented standing upright along the old roads. For example, a party from Captain Cook's voyage reported that they rested in the shade of a standing statue. This would be consistent with upright transport. Number 2. The abandoned and fallen statues near the old roads are most often found face down on downhill routes and face up on their backs on uphill routes. This supports the transport of upright statues that were being transported with their faces forward as if they were walking forward. Number 3. Studies have shown fractures along the bases of the statues in transport. These could have arisen from rocking the statue back and forth and placing great pressures on the edges. And finally, number 4. The statues found along the transport roads have wider bases than the installed statues. This would facilitate more stable transport. Also, stone chips around the installed statues also indicate that the wider base was removed during installation. What are the potential reasons for the collapse of the Rapa Nui civilization? Jared Diamond, the historian, suggested that cannibalism took place on Easter Island after the construction of the Moai. This was because the building of the Moai may have required the use of many trees. If the Moai were transported by rolling them on trees to get them to their final destinations, the use of these many trees then could have led to major deforestation. The deforestation then further destabilized an already precarious ecosystem and further compromised food sources. Initially, the island was home to many species of land birds and trees, including at least 3 species of trees which grew taller than 15 meters or 49 feet. One species of tree in particular was possibly the largest palm trees in the world at that time. A major factor that contributed to the extinction of multiple plant species was the introduction of the Polynesian rat. Studies by paleobotanists have shown rats can dramatically affect the reproduction of vegetation in an ecosystem. In the case of Rapa Nui, recovered plant shell seeds showed markings of being gnawed on by the rats. One scientist wrote, quote, "Sometime before the arrival of Europeans on Easter Island, the Rapa Nui experienced a tremendous upheaval in their social system brought about by a change in their island's ecology. By the time of European arrival in 1722, the island's population had dropped to 2,000 to 3,000 from a high of approximately 15,000 just a century earlier." End quote. Around that same time of 1722, 21 species of trees and all species of land birds became extinct. This occurred through some combination of overharvesting, overhunting, rat predation, and climate change. The island was largely deforested, and it didn't have any trees more than 3 meters or 10 feet tall. Loss of large trees meant that residents were no longer able to build seaworthy vessels, which significantly diminished their fishing abilities. One theory regarding the deforestation that caused such ecological and social damage was that the trees were used to build the statues. The cut trees were used as rollers to move the statues to their final location from a quarry on the island. Deforestation also affected agricultural production on Rapa Nui. Initially, the native tropical forests provided ideal shade cover for soil, but with the native forest being destroyed, the topsoil became eroded, causing a sharp decline in agricultural production. This was further exacerbated by the loss of land birds and the collapse in seabird populations as a potential source of food. By the 1700s, residents of the island were largely sustained by farming, with domestic chickens as the primary source of protein. As the island became overpopulated and resources diminished, warriors, known as Matatoa, gained more power. These warriors shifted the emphasis away from a religious-type worship of ancestors and the Moai statues, and shifted it more towards a cult with increased warfare. This apparently began around the year 1540. This new cult maintained that the living could no longer contact dead ancestors through the Moai statues, but rather through living human beings chosen by a competition. A living Rapa Nui warrior who could contact deceased ancestors was called a birdman, and this new group of warriors are referred to as the birdman cult. The competitions for becoming a birdman started around 1760, after the arrival of the first Europeans. The birdman competitions ended in 1878 due to the construction of the first church by Roman Catholic missionaries who had arrived 14 years earlier. Engravings on rocks representing birdmen on Easter Island are exactly the same as some in Hawaii. This indicated that the birdman concept was probably brought by the original settlers. However, the competition for becoming a birdman was unique to Easter Island. The goal of the birdman contest was to obtain the first egg of the season from a specific offshore island. Contestants descended sheer cliffs and swam to the nearby island where they awaited the arrival of the birds. Once a contestant had an egg, he would swim back to Rapa Nui and present it to his sponsor. This resulted in him having the title and power of Birdman for that year. What happened to the island once Europeans started to visit? A 1994 study asserted that there is little archaeological evidence that the Rapa Nui society started to collapse before the arrival of Europeans. Bone pathology of islanders from the pre-European period clearly suggest few fatalities can be attributed directly to violence. The first recorded European contact with the island was on Easter Sunday in 1722, when the Dutch navigator Jacob Roggeveen visited the island. He stayed on the island for a week and estimated the population at 2,000 to 3,000 inhabitants. The number may have been greater because some natives may have been frightened into hiding. They were hiding because of an initial misunderstanding that led Roggeveen's men to fire on the natives, killing more than a dozen and wounding several more. The next foreign visitors were two Spanish ships in 1770. The Spanish reported the island as largely uncultivated, with a seashore lined with standing stone statues. 4 years later, in 1774, British explorer James Cook visited Easter Island. Cook reported that some statues were lying face down, having been toppled in war. The British ship HMS Blossom arrived in 1825 and reported seeing no standing statues. According to some historians, the statue toppling continued into the 1830s as a part of fierce internal wars. By 1838, the only standing statues were on several specific slopes of the island. Easter Island was approached by visitors many times in the mid-1800s, but by then, the islanders had become openly hostile to any attempt to land. As a result of this isolation, very little new information was reported before the 1860s. In December 1862, Peruvian slave raiders struck. Violent abductions continued for several months, eventually capturing around 1,500 men and women. This was half of the island's population. Among those captured were the island's top chief, his heir, and those who knew how to read and write a specific Polynesian script. The slave raiders were later forced to repatriate the people they had kidnapped, but this created a new problem on Easter Island. Carriers of smallpox disembarked onto the island with some of the surviving natives, creating devastating epidemics. Easter Island's population was reduced so severely that some of the dead weren't even buried. Many natives also died of tuberculosis, which had been introduced by visiting whalers. In 1867, the first Christian missionary to the island died of tuberculosis, and about 25% of the natives also succumbed about that same year. In the following years, missionaries and other settlers started buying the lands of the deceased. This led to great confrontations between natives and settlers. One particular settler bought up all of the island except for the missionaries' area and moved a few hundred natives to Tahiti to work for his backers. In 1871, the missionaries evacuated all but 171 natives to the Gambier Islands. Those natives who remained were mostly older men. 6 years later, In 1877, only 111 people lived on Easter Island, and only 36 of them had any offspring. With over 97% of the population dead or gone in less than a decade, much of the island's cultural knowledge had been lost. Did the island ever recover? Yes. Starting in 1878, the island's population slowly recovered. One particular merchant, Alexander Salmon Jr., worked to repatriate Rapa Nui native workers from his inherited plantation on Tahiti. He also introduced the coconut to Easter Island, one of the first sizable trees on the island since its deforestation 2 centuries earlier. He eventually bought up all lands on the island, with the exception of the missionaries' lands. Alexander Salmon became the island's sole employer and worked to develop tourism. In 1888, he sold his interests in Easter Island to the government of Chile, making Easter Island a territory of Chile. Chile purchased all the remaining lands that had been purchased from the descendants of natives who died during the epidemics. After Chile annexed Easter Island, the surviving natives were confined to a specific part of Easter Island, and the rest was rented as a sheep farm. In 1953, the island was managed by the Chilean Navy for about 13 years. And then finally, in 1966, the entire island was reopened, and all the Rapa Nui natives were granted Chilean citizenship. Catherine Rutledge was a British archaeologist and anthropologist who initiated and carried out most of the first true survey of Easter Island. She did this with her husband and several other scientists and assistants. The team totaled about 12 members. Catherine was the only female on the trip, and also the author of their adventures that you will hear about today. A Visit to Easter Island in 1914. This is the story of and by Catherine Rutledge, the scientist who completed some of the earliest and most valuable studies about Rapa Nui, also known as Easter Island. Here is her story. Let me begin my tale by telling you why I went to Easter Island in 1914. Prior to our journey, it was unknown who built the giant statues on the island and how they were built. The world had known about these incredible statues, called Moai, ever since a Dutch explorer landed on the island in 1722. Since then, no one had done a true scientific analysis to understand the origins of these statues. Prior European visitors to the island just assumed that a small population of indigenous people on that island could not have ever created and raised those enormous statues. Furthermore, it was also believed that any vital information that would explain the origins of the statues had long disappeared from the island. Spoiler alert, those people were wrong. When we arrived, such knowledge and tradition were expiring, but they weren't altogether gone. Our timely visit to Easter Island preserved cultural and historic information that would otherwise have been lost. We spent time with the indigenous people and their tribal elders, recorded their oral histories, and learned about their historic cultures. We excavated about 25 statues on the island, cataloged all the current statues, and studied the quarries where they were created. In spite of language barriers and other difficulties, we were able to rescue many important scientific threads which helped to explain the origin of the statues. Here's another spoiler. The ancestors of the local indigenous people probably did create those statues a long time ago. And they did it with their own hands, their own tools, their own skills, and their intelligence. Okay, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. Let me tell you this tale in chronological order. It all began when we asked the British Museum what major project they were interested in. Their answer was simple. They said Easter Island. Now, I'll be straight with you. That idea didn't excite me at first. Easter Island was a long way from our home in England. We also knew that any type of modern facilities and technology on the island were basically absent. In 1914, Easter Island belonged to Chile, which used the island as a large sheep farm. Yeah, that's it. They were just basically using it as a sheep farm. The only communication between Chile and the island was a small sailing vessel, which only visited once a year to collect the wool from the sheep. A lot of naysayers told us that this trip would be a waste of time. It would just be a long, dangerous voyage, and there wouldn't be any viable clues remaining on the island to explain its history. Well, as you can imagine, that just stoked our fires. So we agreed to do it and secured some private funding. Pox on you, naysayers. One of the first things we did was to get a boat for our journey. Our trusty vessel was a 90-foot schooner named Mana, a Polynesian word meaning Great Spirit or Life Force. We packed our schooner with all of our food and provisions for the long journey. This didn't leave as much room as we had expected for all the supplies we would need when we got to the island. With great effort, we filled our schooner with tents, saddlery, beds, buckets, basins, utensils, and cooking pots. We also brought medical and surgical supplies, but probably too much. We had enough medical supplies for each of us to break a leg every month. Our team doctor lived by the old adage, better safe than sorry. It's hard to argue that point with a doctor. Of course, we also brought all of our vital instruments so we could do our scientific work. This included surveying gear, excavation tools, sounding machines, photographic equipment, and crates of other scientific gear. When we were just about to set sail, a large supply of tobacco arrived for the entire crew. At first, there wasn't any room for the tobacco. Then a small uproar ensued, and somehow most agreed that we would get rid of a toilet to make room for the tobacco. Yeah, make that of what you will. Once the valuable tobacco was on board, final checks were done. Everything on our schooner was carefully secured so that nothing should shift when we hit rough water. In March of 1913, we finally set sail for Easter Island. We had told our friends that we would probably be gone for about 2 years. They said that things in England will probably be very different when we return. We replied to them, "Nah, everything will probably be the same when we return, just like always. You all will still be griping about militants, labor troubles, and home rule. Oh, well, there may be a few new books printed, and the children will be taller, but those will be the only changes." Well, we were quite wrong. While we were away, a global war broke out in 1914. This war involved England, Germany, France, and many other countries. Decades later, this would be called World War I. Yeah, we didn't see that coming. Anyway, we made several stops on the way to Easter Island and ran into some other challenges. Overall, it took us about 1 year to reach the island. Tired and weary, our trusty schooner arrived in March of 1914. As we neared the southern shoreline, our ship's cook, Bailey, asked, "How can I start a fire with no wood?" He was right. The land was mostly barren of trees. Although beautiful in its own way, Easter Island is a far cry from the tropical paradises often associated with the Pacific. The small triangular island is only 13 miles by 7 miles in size. Formed long ago from volcanic activity, we could even view all three of the dormant volcanoes as we arrived closer to the island. The great statues, called Moai, are widely dispersed all around the island. At some point long ago, most stood upright on platforms called Ahu. We would soon be spending lots of time investigating these toppled statues and their curious platforms. We anchored in a small bay where almost all 250 inhabitants of the island lived. Soon enough, boats full of islanders, dressed in a mix of European and local clothing, flocked all around our schooner. Mr. Edmonds, the island's English manager, soon arrived, and he gave us an orientation to the wondrous island. After a few days, though, we did discover an unexpected downside: the insect population, especially the cockroaches. They were everywhere, outdoors, indoors, even sometimes brazenly prancing on our dinner tables. We also had to deal with flies, mosquitoes, white moths, and pesky flying beetles. Another challenge was the water supply. Locals usually collected enough rainwater, but we arrived during a dry spell. As a result, we often heard the dreaded phrase, "The tank is empty." On the upside, we had a reliable supply of milk and could buy as much mutton as we wanted. Bananas and fig trees were also plentiful, but vegetables were few and far between. Due to the lack of trees, the island had scant firewood, so we used oil for cooking and sometimes dried manure. The indigenous people used minimal fuel, typically heating stones in the ground in true Polynesian style. Once we were fully situated and settled in, it was time to tackle our tasks and objectives. We needed to investigate the statues and platforms, do surveying and photography, explore caves for historical importance, and connect with the locals for their insights about the island's history. The indigenous people are generally good-looking and usually quite charming. The older folks are invariably kind, but the younger men, full of self-importance, can sometimes be a bit challenging to deal with. Some older folks had tattoos resembling the rings and girdles on the island statues. Studying the tattoos of the elders helped us to understand and make some connections to the island's history. More importantly, conversations with the elders revealed even more secrets from the past. The memories of these elderly locals were a treasure trove of knowledge for us. Even if they didn't remember every story handed down through generations, they could share customs and folklore that helped piece together the island's history. Unfortunately, the oldest islanders were passing away, so time was of the essence. We prioritized interviews based on urgency and reliability, weighing the clarity of younger memories against the richness of older ones. It felt like a race against the clock, a scientific responsibility we couldn't ignore. Fortunately, the island's elder spokespeople were usually keen to share their wisdom, whether on exploration trips or casual conversations on the porch. They provided invaluable information. Sometimes they visited us, and sometimes we visited them in their homes, often surrounded by banana plants and curious neighbors. We noticed that their memories were more vivid when they were in the comforts of their own homes. But gleaning insights from the human mind proved trickier than deciphering ancient statues. Even well-informed locals would sometimes omit details that seemed obvious to them, but bewildering to us. Inconsistencies weren't usually intentional. When memory faded, imagination often filled in the gaps. This line of work almost felt like a courtroom drama. We had to hear the testimony, gently cross-examine without causing offense, and cross-reference multiple accounts, all while keeping the conversation engaging for both the interviewee and the interpreter. It took months sometimes to figure out exactly what some of their memories about the past meant, and if the information was mostly reliable. It's essential to remember that while the accounts we've gathered are believed to be factual, their absolute accuracy can't be guaranteed. Another challenge was related to the island's leper colony. Some of the most knowledgeable elders lived in this settlement, and we didn't want to leave them out from our process. Despite the health risks and the stories of contagion, we took the gamble. We went into the island's leper colony and had deep and helpful conversations with the elders who lived there. When we departed at the end of each day, we used proper disinfection protocols with a dash of hope, which seemed to have worked. Overall, our interviews with the locals and their elders were valuable. It's clear that today's residents of Easter Island are closely linked to the iconic stone statues. Some even remember the names of clans who crafted them. These current islanders have shown us wooden figures they carve and told us about aspects of a Birdman cult that still partially exists. The wooden figures share similar designs and features with their stone counterparts, suggesting that they belong to the same historical chapter. The Birdman cult also is within living memory, pointing to a continuous thread of tradition with the ancient cult in the island's past. So let's assume that today's inhabitants are direct descendants of the statue builders. Now the question is, who are these people? The theory that Easter Island was populated from South America can pretty much be dropped in a latrine. Their culture and language have undeniable parallels with other Pacific communities. Some lived in caves as their homes, and some lived in houses that were designed like upturned canoes. They were built from sticks, tied at the top, and thatched with reeds, grass, and sugarcane. Close to most houses was a thatched structure that housed an oven. This is where food was cooked Polynesian style. Their menu featured tropical staples like potatoes, bananas, sugarcane, and taro. Meat was limited. Rats were the most common source for their meat, but they did also eat some chicken and fish. The islanders' attire consisted of cloth made from the paper mulberry tree. It was fashioned into loincloths and wraps. Additionally, almost all of the indigenous people had these elaborate tattoos. Their tattoo designs were so precise that earlier explorers had marveled at their intricacy. Their tattoos included everyday items like chisels and fish hooks, and even complex designs like faces. Women were so extensively tattooed that they appeared to be wearing pants. It's intriguing to think the first inhabitants of the island might have been wood carvers by trade, who then adapted to the island's stone resources. It's clear to us, though, that Easter Island's unique volcanic ash made it possible to create these monumental works in the first place. Curiously, today's island residents don't seem all that fascinated by these relics. To them, these statues are as commonplace as rocks or banana trees. One boy even asked us, "Don't you have Moai statues in England?" His simple question and tone put their ambivalence towards the statues in perspective. In addition to the interviews, we also did thorough investigations of the statues themselves, along with their platforms and the quarries they came from. The general design of each statue is consistent, suggesting skilled craftsmanship and a well-established artistic tradition. Each monument has a large torso, with hands nearly touching at the base. But what really catches your eye are the ears. These lobes look like fleshy ropes, and in some cases, you can even see the disc worn in them. The tallest statues tower at over 30 feet, while some are as short as 6 feet. The ones found in burial areas usually range from 12 to 20 feet and they're often crowned with some sort of hat. Many of the statues once stood on pedestals called ahu. These platforms not only held the statues, but also served as burial places for the departed. When someone died, their body was wrapped in a tapa blanket and reed mattress, sometimes accompanied by personal items like fish hooks. The bundled corpse was then brought to a platform and placed on a special wooden framework for public view. While the body was on display, the whole area was considered sacred. Fishing nearby was prohibited, cooking fires were hidden, and relatives stood watch to enforce these taboos. Mourning could last up to 3 years, and it ended with a grand feast. Afterward, the bones were either left on the platform, moved to family vaults, or buried elsewhere. Around 260 of these burial platforms are found all over the island, although mostly along the coastline. Local guides, usually an elder, helped us with mapping out the locations of these structures. To investigate each one, we traveled by horse, often under the hot and scorching sun. On arrival, a member of our team would hop off their horse and shout measurements and other information to me. I would remain on my horse, frantically jotting down all the vital statistics. Over the course of several months, we documented the size, type, and condition of all 260 platforms. We discovered that not every platform was designed to hold a statue, and some are relatively new constructions. Some of the larger statue-bearing platforms were long, sea-facing walls that held up to 15 statues. We calculated that there were about 100 platforms that supported 231 statues at some point in history. The level of craftsmanship varied for the platforms. Some of the ahu featured rough, unfinished stones, while others were intricately crafted. The slow erosion of severe weather and ocean storms have damaged most of these platforms, along with some damage done much more currently. One of the livestock managers, concerned that his sheep were drinking seawater, dismantled some platforms to build a pen for his livestock. Of course, none of the platforms currently held an upright statue. Most figures now lay toppled over like enormous dominoes. Some lay there unbroken, while others shattered when they smashed on the lower wall of the platform during their toppling. No one alive on the island recalls seeing an upright statue on its platform. It is not believed that the destruction was due to earthquakes or any other non-human cause. Some say the figures were toppled during tribal warfare. This warfare was between clans on the island and with clans from nearby islands. It is believed they were pulled over with ropes or by removing supporting stones. The creation of the statues probably spanned several centuries, although we are unsure when they were initially created. When the first European explored Easter Island in 1722, the statues were fully constructed and standing upright in good condition. Soon after, in 1774, European visitors reported some had toppled over. By 1840, none stood upright in their original positions. Most fell face first, their features and details hidden by the buildup of dirt on and around them. We also visited the mountain quarries where these great structures were created. These quarries were made of compressed volcanic ash that was perfect for sculpting. The statues were created in these quarries and then hauled across the island to their platforms. Over 150 statues still lie in the quarries, each in various stages of completion. The incomplete stages actually helped us to really understand the process. Blocks would be initially shaped from the side of the mountain, but not yet separated from its holding place. We could see depressions in the ground where craftsmen stood or crouched while they worked on the blocks. Once the statue's front and sides were fully detailed, the sculptors moved to the trickier part, freeing it from the bedrock. They would chisel away until the statue balanced on a narrow stone strip along its back, resembling a long dorsal fin on the back of a fish. The tools of this ancient craft have also been discovered. Most are made of the same material as the statue themselves and were shaped by flaking. They're pointed at one or both ends, meant to be handheld and discarded when damaged. There's another, rarer tool, a stone blade with a beveled and perpendicular edge for cutting. These appear to be more valuable. The sculptors probably took these tools home each day. Surprisingly, our calculations suggest a statue could be roughed out in just 15 days. Not every stone block reached completion. Sometimes the sculptors discovered a flaw in the stone and had to scrap their initial plans. They'd repurpose that stone for a smaller statue or cut it from a different angle. On another occasion, hard, unworkable stone were found in critical areas like the nose or chin. Since no one wanted a statue with a wart or bulge, these projects were also abandoned. Away from the main quarry, we found intriguing statues that were partially buried. To view these structures in closer detail, we unearthed about 20 to 30 of them in total. They were mostly carved to completion with intricate detailing. Their elongated thumb joints and nails were exceptionally noteworthy. Also, some had such pronounced nipples that some of the locals often mistook them for female figures. But every statue we came across represented a nude male. These statues may have simply been on their way to platforms, but never made it there for unknown reasons. For those statues which did reach their platform, we wondered how they were initially raised upright. Two different techniques for erecting these statues seem to exist, and the choice probably depended on the terrain. One approach involved laying the statue face down in the desired location and then digging a hole beneath its base. As an alternative, some statues were laid face up and gradually lifted into a vertical position using large stones behind them for support as they were hoisted. We understand that the platforms held the statues and also served as a place for burial rituals. We have less of an understanding of what the statues truly symbolized. Many elders offered different explanations. Some of the statues may represent gods, and some may represent ancestor figures. They may also symbolize rank, status, mark territorial boundaries, and some may even just be decorative. We spent about a year and a half on the island, and I feel we unearthed more questions than answers. In the end, though, my greatest discovery was my deep love for this ancient and wondrous island. In August of 1915, I departed Easter Island to head back home. I brought back some of its secrets in my notebooks, but more importantly, I brought back all of its beauty in my heart. Catherine Rutledge published her findings in 1919. Most of her scientific conclusions are accepted to this day. Her paper records have been preserved by the Royal Geographical Society in London. And to this day, scientists who study Easter Island still make use of her valuable field notes and research data. This is the end of the episode. I hope you enjoyed this bonus episode of Calm History. Thank you for your kind support. I truly appreciate it.